This program has been described by AudioVision. For information on over 400 video and audio titles, call toll-free 1-866-966-7667 or visit our accessible website, www.audiovisioncanada.com. The contents of this program are protected by copyright and may not be duplicated or used for any commercial purpose without the express written consent of the copyright holders.
A Hammer production. Sunrise in the City of London. The Satanic Rites of Dracula, with narrative description by AudioVision Canada. Starring Christopher Lee. Peter Cushing. Michael Coles. Also starring William Franklin, Freddie Jones, Joanna Lumley, Richard Vernon. The winged statue of Eros towers over Piccadilly Circus. With Patrick Barr, Barbara Yu Ling, Lockwood West, Richard Matthews, Maurice O'Connell, Valerie Van Ost. Assistant Director, Derek Whitehurst. Sound Recordist, Claude Hitchcock. Sound Editor, Terry Poulton. Casting Director, James Liggett. Special Effects, Les Bowie. Production Manager, Ron Jackson. Art Director, Lionel Couch. Editor, Chris Barnes. Associate Producer, Don Houghton. Director of Photography, Brian Coben. Music composed by John Cockars. Musical Supervisor, Philip Martel. Screenplay by Don Houghton. Along the embankment from the Tower of London, the Tower Bridge spans the Thames. Produced by Roy Skeggs. Directed by Alan Gibson. A grand country house glows in the blue light of the moon. Inside, in a red chamber, four white-robed figures sit around a table in front of a black mass altar. Two red-robed young women approach the altar. As an Asian priestess raises a golden chalice over the altar, the robed figures get to their feet.
Hear ye, great demons of hell! Watch over thee.
In another room, a guard monitors the ceremony electronically.
Thus do we dedicate ourselves to your service and your commands.
A slim young blonde woman lies nude on the altar.
We accept your guidance and your mighty power.
Pouring a cup of coffee from a thermos, the guard leaves his room. He walks along a hallway past several other rooms. A door opens at the end of the hall. The guard hands the coffee cup to a second guard and leaves. Setting his coffee down on a table, the second guard sits down and flips the page of the magazine he's reading. The guard glances over at a man lying on a bed in the corner. Then he returns to his magazine. The man on the bed peers at the guard beneath lowered eyelids. Closes his eyes and lies still, feigning sleep. His hands have been tied behind his back, and he works quietly to free them. Grimacing, the prisoner slips one hand free of the rope. The guard drinks his coffee, oblivious. The guard looks over at the prisoner, who seems to be stirring in his sleep. The guard walks over to the bed. Bending, he examines his prisoner. As the guard checks the bonds at the prisoner's ankles, the prisoner sits up and slings the rope around the guard's neck. Hauling the guard down onto the bed, he proceeds to strangle him. Summoning all his strength, the prisoner rolls the guard onto the floor and falls on top of him while maintaining his grip on the rope. The guard goes limp. The prisoner collapses and struggles to regain his breath. Pushing himself to his feet, the prisoner staggers backwards across the room. The door cautiously, checks to see if the way is clear, then steps out into the hallway. Groggy, he limps along the hallway past a succession of closed doors. Peers through an open doorway to see the first guard seated at his monitoring station. Then he sneaks past, unobserved. Glancing over his shoulder, the prisoner descends the staircase to the foyer of the house. He pauses as he crosses the foyer, then moves on. Pushes his way through a set of double doors, he fails to notice the light beam of a motion detector. The sensor triggers alarms in the monitoring station and the red chamber. Rushing into the hallway with a weapon in his hand, the guard runs toward the doorway of the prisoner's room. In the red chamber, the robed figures leap to their feet. As the prisoner hurries into the night, another guard starts his motorcycle. As he staggers down the driveway, the prisoner spots the motorcycle racing toward him across the lawn. Clinging to the gate at the end of the drive, he sees a car waiting for him. The motorcycle bears down on him, but the prisoner lurches for cover. Shot by someone in the car, the motorcyclist crashes through the gate. Another guard speeds toward the commotion. An alarm light flashes on the gatepost as the prisoner staggers into the driveway. Seeing the approaching motorcycle, he tries to run but falls. The guard dismounts. But as he hurries toward the prisoner, he takes a bullet in the head. Regaining his feet, the prisoner scrambles toward the car, but collapses before he can get in. He's pulled into the car, which drives off into the night. Later,
I'm the same.
The prisoner lies on a table, bleeding from his head wounds.
Same.
As a doctor prepares an injection, a man and a woman tape record the prisoner.
Some power. Something greater.
You're sure John Porter was there? You're sure it was John Porter?
Sure. They are filthy, obscene rites. I saw an altar, a young girl on it, naked. She lies there, waiting for the sacrifice, a cockerel to be killed.
He remembers the priestess, her arms outstretched over the girl on the altar. An assistant picks up a golden chalice and a dagger. The robed figures watch as the priestess suspends the cockerel by its feet over the girl. As the priestess slits the bird's throat, the girl gasps. Blood drips from the cockerel's beak into the chalice.
They call on the name of the devil. They seem to take strength from their own blasphemy. You want proof. God, photos.
The doctor removes the prisoner's watch.
I've lost them. All involved.
All right, now let's go through this again. Tell me more about this ritual.
The doctor shakes his head. The prisoner has lost consciousness. The man, doing the questioning, takes the watch from the doctor and joins an older man seated at a conference table reading a file.
You'd never have gone in, putting him in as one of the guards. They must have been picked men. They're bound to be caught.
He volunteered.
Nobody volunteers in this department.
Does he still maintain that John Porter was there?
Yes, he seems to be certain about that. Porter and four others, five men in all.
It's going to make life difficult for all of us, isn't it?
Because he's a minister of the Crown?
Because of the Right Honourable John Porter, his direct responsibility for this department.
Perhaps he just forgot about us.
In any case, we have no proof, no real proof.
A tiny roll of film is extracted from the watch.
In some sort of sick orgy, that's what we've got.
Maybe the proof's in there.
Even if it is, we don't know if we can use it.
So that poor devil is simply suffering for absolutely nothing.
That poor devil isn't suffering any longer. He's dead.
The woman rewinds the audio tape.
It's a miracle he lasted as long as he did. Obviously, he'd been systematically beaten and tortured.
Yes, thank you, Doctor. Let me have your written report later.
I don't suppose anyone will be allowed to claim him, will they? Usual routine, false name on the death certificate.
Then a departmental whip round for the burial.
The doctor wheels the prisoner out of the room.
Would you like to hear this played back now, sir?
No, not now.
I would leave it here. Get this down to the photo lab. Tell them to make prints of anything that comes up. Anything at all.
Have the tape transcribed later and, then put in a red dossier and file it in the number 2 security vault under seal.
Yes, sir.
Number 2 vault, eh? You really are going to close the door on this whole issue.
I might have to. As far as the department's concerned, as far as I'm concerned. Officially.
What's that supposed to mean? I've called somebody in to give you a hand. Someone who doesn't have our resources, but does have a certain independence. Political independence. A man called Murray. Inspector Murray.
Scotland Yard.
Special branch. Don't worry. He's all right. It's his job.
Oh, that's comforting.
Inside this room, you have my blessing and my cooperation. Outside, you're on your own. And I mean that. Put a foot wrong and the powers that be will finish you. You'd probably join Hanson.
Thanks.
The next day, beside the fountains in Trafalgar Square, a flock of pigeons takes wing. Hanson's boss, Torrance, turns on a slide projector at the Security Service headquarters.
We've been running some routine security checks on certain listed VIPs. We got a whisper on the grapevine that some of them may have been visiting a house in Croxted Heath.
He turns off the lights.
Visiting it regularly. We didn't know who they were. This is the place. Pelham House, headquarters of what has always been regarded as a harmless organization. Psychical Examination and Research Group, PURGE for short.
So you sent an operative in undercover?
Yes, Hanson. He witnessed a couple of pretty weird sessions.
At Pelham House, the blonde girl lies naked upon the altar.
Hear ye, great demons of hell. Watch over these thy disciples. Give them thy power. Frail mankind. Thus do we dedicate ourselves to your service and your commands. Thus, with this baptism of blood, we walk in the eternal footsteps of the cursed. To know the inner secrets of those who move beyond the realms of the unknown and into the precincts of Hades.
Anointed with the cockerel's blood, the girl writhes ecstatically.
Yesterday they rumbled him and tried to make him talk.
So they're alerted now? What is it? An espionage network?
That must be our assumption.
Moscow or Peking?
Well, we don't know. Nothing ties in. There's no single known link.
He switches on the lights.
And there's no whispers from any informers.
From the photo lab. They found 5 exposures on the microfilm. Bit blurry, but they've given them special processing.
Right, thanks, Jim.
The transcription?
All finished, sir. Sealed and bolted.
Thank you. You can't have had much rest in the last 12 hours. You'd better cut along home.
Thank you, sir.
Turn off the light as you go out, would you, Jane? Well?
No doubt about that one. Generals are out there, Freeborn, Imperial General Staff.
At Pelham House, Freeborn, one of the robed figures, approaches the altar. He runs a fingertip through the blood pooled in the girl's navel.
Thus, by the 6,000 terrors of hell, are you anointed.
Freeborn paints a cross of blood on his forehead.
Good Lord.
The next slide comes up.
So Hansen was right.
Well, that's Porter, isn't it?
Yes, the Right Honourable John Porter, MP. Minister with special responsibilities for our security services. Pity he didn't stick to collecting spiders.
At Pelham House, Porter dips his finger in the girl's navel.
Thus, by the nameless monsters of the lower depths, are you called?
A nod from him and a dozen civil service pensions go out of the window, including mine.
He could dissolve this department in 2 seconds flat.
So that's why you're working without official sanction.
He's not too difficult either. Lord Carradine, next to the church and the government, one of the biggest landowners in England.
Still owns half of London.
Lord Carradine approaches the altar.
The 7 lords of darkness, are you damned?
Professor Julian Keeley.
Not the Nobel Prize winner.
Yes, I'm sure it is. Expert in the fields of bacteriology, germ warfare and diseases of the blood.
Runs the Keeley Foundation here in London.
Keeley's hand trembles as he dips into the blood in the girl's navel.
And 7 times 7, damned again.
Keeley glances apprehensively at Qin Yang, the priestess.
Thus, to defy the common laws of man and righteousness.
There were 5 photos, Peter, let's have the 5th.
A photo of an empty corridor comes up on screen.
What's this then?
He slipped up over this one.
He spoke of 5 men.
Well, he was punchy. He'd had a hell of a beating. It's a wonder we got anything at all out of him. It could only have been 4.
It's enough. I'll have the dossiers released on Keeley, Porter, and the others. I'll see what can be dug up.
Never seen the Colonel, Elvis. Perhaps the Colonel's never had quite so much provocation before.
An Austin Mini pulls out of the departmental garage to find a milk truck blocking the lane. Behind the wheel, Jane waits for the milkman to finish, oblivious to the motorcyclist watching her. As she pulls away, a second motorcyclist waits for her at the end of the lane. Out in traffic, the motorcyclists pass a Land Rover as they tail the Mini. Jane spots them in her rearview mirror and turns the corner, but the motorcyclists stay with her. The way seems clear, but then the motorcyclists pull in behind her in the next block. Jane speeds along a service road, trying to outrun the motorcyclists. The road is a dead end. Jane brakes hard as the motorcyclists stop just behind her. As she backs up to turn around, the motorcyclists dismount and run over to the Mini. Jane closes her windows. One of the motorcyclists smashes a pipe through the windshield. He reaches inside for Jane. Back at the department, the tape of Hansen's statement is started.
the baptism of blood. It acts on them like some kind of drug.
In Hansen's account, Keeley and Lord Carradine look on as the priestess performs the ceremony over the naked body of the girl. Porter watches in fascination as Qin Yang holds her dagger high, then plunges it into the girl's heart. General Freeborn's eyes dart to the flashes of light that illuminate the chamber as the girl writhes in pain. The victim goes limp as Qin Yang pulls the dagger from her heart.
The girl dies. The woman puts a cloak over her. Over the blood. His blood pouring from the wound. His blood.
Torrance switches on his electric razor.
Blood. All right. There's a man I worked with once. He's an academic type, but he knows about this sort of thing. Professor Lorimer Van Helsing. He's a university lecturer in anthropology and Eastern European history. He's a scientist. But what may prove to be even more important to us, he's an authority on the occult. He really knows about the black arts, satanic rites,
and what?
Other things?
Later, in Van Helsing's office...
Crosses. They have inverted crosses marked in blood. And as the woman goes to the altar, there's a strange power there, filling the whole house. She felt it. Strong, weird power.
In Hansen's account,
death is no prison to those who have given their souls to the Prince of Darkness.
Keeley watches, wide-eyed, as Qin Yang peels a black cloth from the blood-spattered body on the altar. The girl's eyes pop open. Slowly, she sits up. She turns to Keeley and smiles at him. Then she gazes down at the gaping, bloody wound in her chest. The rivulets of blood dry up and disappear, and the gash in her skin closes up until no sign of it remains. She favors Keeley with another smile. Running her hands over her lithe, naked body, the girl stretches her arms out to the men around the altar. Professor Van Helsing switches off the tape recorder and sits smoking intently.
Hobgoblins and witches and things that go bump in the night.
Yes. Well, hobgoblins are fantasy creatures of the nursery, Mr. Torrance. As for witches, they certainly exist, although 90% of them are charlatans.
But things do go bump in the night. Quite often.
Well, what do you think, Professor? Is it just a black mass ritual?
No. No, not exactly. In the Dark Ages, the worship of natural substances was quite common. The soil, water, sands of the desert, various plants. But the strongest cults were those that worshipped the most mystical substance of all, the fountainhead of life itself. The glorification of blood.
Thank you.
Torrance lights Van Helsing's cigarette.
Now, more often than not, human blood. Now, what your man Hansen witnessed was a very ancient ritual ceremony. It has all the elements. The slaughter of the cockerel, the inherent vileness of evil triumphant, the obscenities, the marking of the supplicants, the human sacrifice. Now, that, of course, could be faked, but it's the symbolism that counts.
The worship of blood. Well, I can understand young kids taking a fly at it just for kicks, but we're talking about sophisticated, mature adults.
It isn't unique. The notorious Hellfire Club of the 18th century was comprised solely of the elite brains of this country. The wisest men of Asia were firmly convinced that human blood was the elixir of youth. And those who adhere to the cult of vampirism are usually sophisticated, mature adults.
These are the people who fully realize its tremendous potential. And one of these men could be the motivating force, the menace, and the power.
Are these men involved in this whole business because they're under some kind of threat? Or drugs?
Or hypnosis. This particular evil is more potent and more addictive than heroin, I assure you. And the end result is just as fatal.
I'd like to see inside Pelham House.
Yes, but they're already alerted.
Coffee, Grandfather.
What a pleasant surprise. Thank you.
A pretty young redhead brings a tray into the office.
You know my granddaughter, Inspector?
Yes, indeed. Nice to see you again, Jessica.
Hello.
Jessica, this is Mr. Peter Torrance.
Excuse me.
Jessica is my right hand. Sometimes I think she knows more about my work than I do myself. There's little sense in trying to keep secrets from her. She has an ingrained curiosity, the hallmark of a true scientist.
Do you take milk and sugar in your coffee, Mr. Torrance?
No, plain black.
Thank you. Well, I still think it'd be worth a trip out to Crocs again.
What?
Pelham House. I'd still like to take a look inside.
Oh, Professor Julian Keeley.
You know him?
I've met him. He's been here once or twice. But you know him, Grandfather. You know him very well.
Is that true, sir?
Yes, I know him. We met at Oxford. He was reading biochemistry. But when I saw that photograph, I just couldn't believe it. Not Keeley. I was going to tell you later.
Oh, college chums and all that.
I thought I might see him first, speak to him, find out if he's really involved.
Why not?
Eh?
Well, it's worth a try. And chances are that a friend could get more out of him than you or I. Yes, it's worth a try.
Under an overcast sky, Van Helsing walks along a street near the Albert Hall. Brass plaque reading "The Keeley Foundation for Science" reflects Van Helsing's image as he approaches the building. Van Helsing steps to the front door and rings the bell. Helsing steps back from the door and glances up at the second story, where a curtain waves in an open window. Van Helsing walks around the side of the building. He tries a door and finds it unlocked. Glancing round, he enters the building, failing to notice the motorcyclist observing him in his rearview mirror. The motorcyclist dismounts and enters a phone booth. Inside, in the laboratory, Professor Keeley peers through a microscope. Removing a slide from the microscope, he compares it to the culture in a petri dish. Keeley looks up from the slide as Van Helsing lets himself in.
Julian?
I've finished. It's all finished. I've finished it.
Hello, Julian. It's Lorimer.
Lorimer?
Lorimer Van Helsing.
Lorimer.
You told me any time I was passing.
Lorimer. Van Helsing. It's not terribly convenient just now. What I mean is...
I'm sorry, I happen to be in the neighborhood.
Very
just
busy.
Thought I'd pop in. On what? What are you working on these days? I must say you have some splendid equipment here.
Keeley covers the petri dish with his hand and removes it from Van Helsing's sight. Van Helsing kneels to clean up the broken glass.
I'm sorry if I startled you.
I was concentrating. Leave that, will you?
What's wrong, Julian?
Nothing.
and just a bit tense, Lorimer. You know, sleepless nights, mental fatigue. I have been ill. A sort of temporary breakdown, but I'll be over it soon.
Oh, my dear chap, I'm so sorry.
The project. I had a deadline, you see. It had to be completed by the 23rd of this month. Always fighting the clock. But I did what they wanted me to, and I've still time to spare. All the answers just came. Quite suddenly. It happens like that occasionally, doesn't it?
Van Helsing nods.
There is. There's still time before the 23rd, isn't there?
Van Helsing turns his gaze to Keeley's petri dish cultures. Out in the country, at Pelham House, Jade wakes up on a bed. Her face is marred by scratches and bruises, and she sports a fresh scab on her lip. As she glances around the room, trying to get her bearings, she notices the single light bulb swinging from the ceiling beneath a metal shade. Jane lies shivering on the bed. Looking up, Jane locates the source of the noise, a shutter banging against the window frame. She turns to find the door rattling against its latch. As Jane cowers against the wall, a mist creeps under the door into the room, and the light swings wildly. Bursts open. A tall, thin man in a black cape enters, his long face distinguished and somber. As he walks slowly toward the bed, Jane cringes. But as he draws near, Jane smiles up at him, eagerly. Sitting on the bed beside her, he lays a hand on her thigh. She grips his wrist and gazes into his eyes. He caresses her cheek as he meets her gaze. Responding to his caresses, Jane looks deep into his dark, hypnotic eyes. As he lays Jane back against the pillows, she pulls him to her, and he sinks his teeth into the flesh of her neck. Meanwhile, back at Keeley's lab...
Evil rules, you know.
Van Helsing stares at him, incredulous.
It really does. Evil and violence are the only two measures that hold any power. Look at the world. Chaos. It is a preordained pattern. Violence, greed, intolerance, sloth. Jealousy. The deadly sins. Or the deadly virtues.
He bends down to Van Helsing, who sits at a desk with Keeley's notes.
The supreme being is the devil, Lorimer. Serve him, and he offers you immortality. He removes death, the common enemy. Nothing is too vile.
Keeley crosses the room.
Nothing is too dreadful. Too awful.
He picks up a petri dish.
You need to know the terror. The horror, Lorimer. You need to feel the thrill of disgust. The beauty of obscenity.
Julian!
Van Helsing stands.
In God's name! What is it you're working on?
Keeley pushes past the professor.
Better let your ill tongue be served,
Julian!
Van Helsing slaps him, and Keeley falls on a couch.
Help me. Help me, Larval.
Julia! Now, these notes, they refer to a new strain of Bacillus pestis. Bubonic plague! The Black Death! Not a cure for it. Not a preventative technique. But a means of accelerating it.
That is necessary. I had to do it.
Keeley stares up at Van Helsing.
I found the new strain. Bacillus pestis. But more virulent than any known species. I grew the bacilli in agar and then exposed them to radioactive neutrons.
Keeley turns away.
Any infected creature suffers the most indescribable symptoms. The flesh literally rots on the bones. And the contagion spreads by touch like wildfire. Everything accelerates beyond any imagination. Within seconds, the disease takes over the whole system.
And the bacilli is growing in these petri dishes?
They are now fully matured. They can live in a saline solution indefinitely.
Why the plague, Bacillus, Julian? You, Professor Julian Keeley, awarded the Nobel Prize for Science and Humanity. Why, Julian? You're going to tell me who commissioned you to work on this atrocity. And what is so important to you and to them?
A motorcycle guard creeps in behind Van Helsing.
Otherwise, I shall have no alternative but to report this whole matter to higher authorities.
Van Helsing turns to find the guard aiming a pistol at him and falls to the floor.
Don't blame me. It's not my fault.
Semi-conscious, Van Helsing blinks up at the scientist. The guard pulls Keeley to his feet.
He threatened me. My work's all finished.
His vision blurred, Van Helsing sees the guard lead Keeley away. At Pelham House, the tall, distinguished vampire strides along a hallway, Jane unconscious in his arms. At Keeley's lab, Van Helsing regains consciousness. He sits up and touches the wound on his forehead where the bullet grazed him. He looks across the room to find Keeley hanging from the rafters, a noose around his neck.
Oh, dear God.
Getting to his feet, Van Helsing crosses the room as Keeley twists slowly at the end of his rope. Appalled, Van Helsing gazes at Keeley's bulging eyes and protruding tongue. Then he notices that the petri dishes of plague bacillus are missing from the lab. That night, a sedan stops on the road outside Pelham House.
Look, you heard what my grandfather said. I know his work. I might spot something you could overlook.
I'm sorry, Jessica. It's just out of the question.
We're not playing games.
Actually, there is a way you can be of use to us, Jessica.
How?
By waiting here. And if by some chance we shouldn't be back within an hour, get on to Gadsby at the yard on 356 and tell him what happened, will you? And, be quiet.
Leaving Jessica by the car, Torrance and Murray approach the gate in the wrought iron fence surrounding the grounds of Pelham House. Murray pushes the button on the intercom.
State your name and business, please.
Murray. Inspector Murray. Police.
A red light flashes on the intercom. And the gate swings open. Murray and Torrance enter the grounds. Just before the gate swings closed, Jessica darts through the opening. Murray and Torrance walk up the driveway toward Pelham House. Hanging back in the shadows, Jessica slips in among the trees. As Murray and Torrance reach the house, the front door swings open. Torrance turns to Murray.
Well, you are the law.
Murray leads the way inside.
What is it?
They find Chin Yang on the stairs.
Police, ma'am.
Police? What can the police possibly want with us?
Well, apparently there was some sort of disturbance in the roadway just outside your gates last night. Some nearby residents complained.
There are no nearby residents.
It was a very still night, perhaps the sound carried.
Didn't you hear anything?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I did. Some hooligans on motorcycles. I hardly thought it worth reporting.
Well, the complainants felt that the hooligans might be using this house as a rallying point. It's ridiculous, of course, but we have to look into these things.
How very bizarre. They are supposed to hide in the dark corners of Pelham House, are they?
Outside, Jessica creeps through the woods. At the back of the house, she finds a door. Lifting the latch, she pushes the door open. About to step inside, she stops at the sight of the motion detector light beam across the threshold. She steps carefully over the beam and enters the house. Carrying a flashlight, Jessica enters a vaulted cellar. She plays the light across several large wooden crates resting on the floor of a wine cellar. In one corner, her light picks out an interior entrance to the cellar. Jessica walks through the room, giving the crates a cursory examination. She fails to notice Jane, asleep or unconscious, in the shadows. Mounting the short flight of stairs to the entrance, she tries the doorknob. The door is locked. As Jessica switches on the cellar lights, Jane's eyes pop open. Descending the stairs, Jessica suddenly sees Jane chained to the wall. She edges toward Jane, who keeps her face averted as Jessica approaches. Jessica lifts Jane's wrist, looking for a pulse. As she checks the lock securing Jane to the wall, Jane turns to her, grinning wickedly. Reaching out to caress Jessica's red hair, Jane smiles. Her incisors have become fangs. She lunges for Jessica's throat, but the chains constrain her, and Jessica pulls free. As Jessica backs away from the vampire that Jane has become, a hand lifts the lid of one of the wooden crates from the inside. Jessica recoils from the young blonde vampire girl sitting up in the open crate. Another crate opens to reveal a vampire woman. Jessica tries to run, but a third vampire blocks her path. Jessica backs away, caught in a circle of vampires. One vampire grabs Jessica's leg and runs her hand up her body. Jessica struggles as the vampire removes her jacket and tears the sleeve of her blouse. Jessica cringes as hands reach for her from the tightening circle. Upstairs, with Chin Yang, Murray and Torrance hear Jessica's screams. As they search for a way into the cellar, Jane throws Jessica to the floor, and the other vampires close in on her. Finding the cellar door locked, Torrance shoots the lock off. Dorrance and Murray kick the door in to find Jessica on the floor, surrounded by four vampires. Jessica hurries to Torrance.
Oh, please, let's get out of here. Oh, please, take me away.
As they make their way up the stairs.
Peter, please. Oh, don't leave me here. Oh, please, help me.
Jane.
Help me.
Torrance runs to rescue Jane.
Stop him. She's a vampire.
Peter!
As Torrance wrestles with her chains, Jane bares her fangs and pulls him to her.
Pull yourself free, man!
He jams his hand under Jane's chin, struggling to hold her off. Murray tries to pull a shelf from the wall, but cannot. Instead, he slams down the lid of a crate. Murray rips a piece of wood off the crate. Lunging at Jane, he rams the point into her heart. Jane collapses and slumps against her chains as she dies. Torrance stares at her, badly shaken. But Murray pulls him away, and Jessica leads them out of the cellar. Upstairs, Qin Yang flicks some switches on a control panel, then picks up a telephone.
Okay.
Murray leads Jessica and Torrance through the hallway and into the foyer. Pushing through the front doors, they make their way outside onto the grounds of Pelham House. Torrance leads them around the side of the house at a run. Crossing the grounds behind the house, Torrance spots the motorcycle guards, alerted by Qin Yang. The first guard closes in on them, but Torrance fires and brings him down. As the second guard approaches, Torrance hurries to catch up with the others. A high brick wall encloses the grounds at the rear. Torrance boosts Murray to the top. He gives Jessica a boost, and Murray hauls her up by the wrists. Then Murray helps Torrance over the wall. Later, back at Van Helsing's...
Keeley behaved like a man demented, obsessed, utterly lost.
Van Helsing picks up a decanter from a side table.
All but the last vestige of sanity had left him. His words were prompted by some force, some nightmare outside himself. It is a shadow, a specter that haunts us all.
Murray, why the hell didn't you get your people to raid Pelham House? You should have called them the moment you got out of the damn place.
Well, as a matter of fact, sir. I'm sorry, Colonel. Inspector Murray was quite right. At the time the police could have got there, they would have found nothing.
Nothing? What about that Chinese woman? What about all those unfortunate creatures in the cellar?
We are not dealing with ordinary criminals, Colonel Matthews. Nor with enemy agents. These people have powers beyond anything you can imagine.
You didn't help Professor Keeley.
Well, he's out of it now anyway.
One down and three to go. The Keeley Foundation. Who started it? Whose money's behind it?
Thank you.
Some tycoon called Denham. D.D. Denham. There's very little known about him. He lives in the heart of the Denham building, I think. He allows no press interviews or photographs. What a clue. Denham. Mean something?
A link, possibly a major one.
Torrance walks into the study and picks up a file folder.
Yes, here we are. The Denham Group of Companies. Chemicals, oils, banks. Board of Directors, Denham himself. The Right Honourable John Porter. Lord Carradine.
General Freeborn.
And Keeley.
And Uncle Tom Copley and all.
Man. Denham. Perhaps Handsome is right.
I think he was. You've already seen a manifestation of vampirism. The cult lives, it breathes, it spreads its vileness like a contagion, like the plague. And my family has fought this corruption for generations. Each time it was destroyed, so it has risen again, like the phoenix, not hell-bent on revenge, only this time.
This time, I believe it's not merely a personal vendetta, but something infinitely more far-reaching. The plague bacillus, Pelham House, the mental destruction of intellectuals such as Professor Keeley and the others. It is all an integral part of a means to a definite end. The real force, the shadow I spoke of, is more sinister, more obscene than any monstrosity you can think of. Lord of corruption, master of the undead.
Count Dracula.
Is there really such a creature?
You should have been in that bloody cellar, Colonel.
Incredible. My department is being closed down. Orders of John Porter. Half my staff have been arrested. Two have been killed. They've labeled us subversives, and the heavies are damn well looking for us. And all this because of a vampire? Van Helsing, for God's sake.
Jessica, you should be resting.
Oh, I'm all right, Grandfather.
Thank you. I destroyed Count Dracula once. It was more than 2 years ago in St. Bartol's churchyard. But this creature can live again by reincarnation. It requires a disciple, someone well-versed in the ritual.
The Chinese woman, Chinyue?
Possibly. She would have to know the exact location of Dracula's grave. I passed the site of St. Bartholomew's tonight. The churchyard has long since vanished. An office block has been built there now.
Van Helsing remembers stopping by the office block and reading a plaque commemorating St. Bartholomew's.
That new building is about 2 years old.
Well, if it's been there for 2 years...
That means this thing has been around since then.
So it would seem. And those women in the cellar, their names have probably been on the files of your missing persons bureau for 2 years. Anyway, that new office block belongs to the Denham Group of Companies. Now, I don't know whether the fifth guest was D.D. Denham, but this I do know. Vampires are spectral creatures. The image casts no reflection in a mirror. Nor can the lens of a camera record their likeness.
He hands Torrance Hansen's photo of the seemingly empty corridor at Pelham House.
So there was someone there.
Or something. Your man Hansen saw it, but his camera couldn't record it.
How the hell do you fight a vampire?
Cloves of garlic.
There are many ways. The symbols of good are used to combat the forces of evil. The crucifix, the word of God, is written in the Holy Bible. Clear, running water symbolizing purity. And it lives in mortal dread of silver.
Anything else?
The hawthorn tree, which provided Christ with his crown of thorns. The light of day.
And a wooden stake driven through the heart.
What about the 23rd, the date that Keeley
mentioned? Yes, indeed, the 23rd of this month. That, I fear, is the worst of all. It is the Sabbath for the undead.
What significance has that?
There are satanic circles which govern our fate and the fate of this earth, perhaps even the universe. Now, throughout history, there are certain times, certain dates which are marked by awesome catastrophes. Each event is carefully plotted and a definite pattern emerges. Every disaster this world has ever suffered coincides with the point wherein these circles meet and cross. In this century alone, they heralded the outbreak of two devastating world wars.
And another disaster is imminent?
Could be.
The 23rd, that's the day after tomorrow.
Now, this must happen tomorrow at midnight.
Well, that's even sooner.
At that hour, the devil holds a balance of power. He marshals his disciples, the living and the dead.
In satanic covens, it is the celebration of supreme blasphemy, the Sabbath for the undead.
I've heard of the witches' Sabbath.
Now, this date is much more important, more profound. Even more significant than the night of Valpurgis. Now, Keeley said the bacillus had to be ready by the 23rd. Why? The date chosen by Dracula himself. The 23rd day of this 11th month. The emerging pattern, you see. The night of the soulless ones.
And in the turmoil and fear that follows, a group of warped men emerge to take control. A politician, a soldier, an industrialist, a landowner.
But Dracula would eventually end up with a totally barren earth.
With any disease and dead bodies to feed on, surely even the vampire himself would perish.
Perhaps deep in his subconscious, that is what he really wants. An end to
it all. He is a cursed immortal, existing on violence, fear, and dread. But suppose he, now just suppose he yearns for final peace. What then? He'd want to bring down the whole universe with him. The ultimate revenge. Thousands dying of the plague. Like the shadow of death itself, one figure scything its way through the terror and anguish. Count Dracula. It is the biblical prophecy of Armageddon.
The next day, two figures stand beneath trees on a hill in the countryside. Jessica walks over to Murray as he scans the scene below through his binoculars. There is no sign of life at Pelham House.
Nothing. Nothing at all. It all seems so unbelievable by the light of day.
But it's not.
As Murray continues his surveillance, Torrance walks up the road to join them.
Well, what's going on? I'm not doing any good hanging around here.
Professor Van Helsing is still at home. I'm with the Colonel down in the car.
Thought there's some hanging around.
Yes, I know.
As Torrance walks away, Murray hands his binoculars to Jessica. Torrance approaches the Colonel's Bentley.
Well, they're all right, sir. A bit impatient, of course, but... Colonel?
He peers into the car. As Torrance claps him, the Colonel topples over, displaying a single bullet hole in his forehead. Torrance draws his revolver as he backs out of the car and scans his surroundings. Deep in the woods, one of the motorcycle guards fires his rifle. Torrance sprawls across the hood of the car and tumbles to the ground, dying. Meanwhile, back in his study, Professor Van Helsing lights the butane burner on his desk and places a crucible over the flame. Opening a drawer, he takes out a small jewel box and turns an object out in his hand. It's a small silver cross, and he drops it in the crucible. Removing a Bible and a crucifix from the drawer and placing them on his desk, he turns up the gas flame under the crucible. The silver cross begins to melt. While Van Helsing waits, he smokes a cigarette as he gazes out the window, thinking. Meanwhile, Jessica studies Pelham House through the binoculars.
It'll be getting dark soon.
You should have heard something by now.
Glancing at the molten silver in the crucible, Van Helsing turns off the flame. He removes a bullet mold from a felt-lined box on his desk. Holding the bullet mold over a cloth, he pours the molten silver into it. Wiping the mold with a cloth, he uses a pair of pliers to knock off the excess silver. Then he ejects the casting onto his desk. Using a pair of needle-nosed pliers, he scrutinizes a perfectly cast silver bullet. Van Helsing opens the breech of a small pearl-handled pistol. Then he glances over at the etching of Count Dracula hanging on his wall. Back on the hill...
It's a sniper! Get down!
fragments of bullet.
I didn't hear a shot.
He's using a silencer. Could be anywhere. We'd better get the hell out of here if he gets us pinned down. Ow! Run like hell!
Murray leads Jessica by the hand across a field. Back in the woods, the sniper breaks cover and sets off after Murray and Jessica. As the sniper reaches the top of the hill, Murray and Jessica sprint for the cover of the trees at the edge of the field. Kneeling behind a fallen tree trunk, the sniper takes aim. Just as Murray and Jessica reach the woods, Jessica trips.
Come on, Jesse, the road can't be far away.
The sniper misses again.
Look, Jessica, he's only playing with us. He could pick us off at any time. Now, come on. Come on!
Seizing her hand, he pulls her to her feet and runs deeper into the woods.
Thank God the Colonel's car's still there. Come on. Come on, Colonel, let's get the engine started. Let's get moving.
In the back seat, a guard points his silenced pistol at Murray.
Stop!
A second guard knocks Murray out. That night, the lights burn inside the D.D. Denham Group of Companies office block. Van Helsing pauses to read the St. Bartholf's commemorative plaque. Then he walks across the forecourt to the entrance of the building. Pushing through the revolving door, he enters the lobby of the building and approaches the security desk.
Good evening. I'd like to see Mr. Denham. Mr. D.D. Denham.
I'm sorry, sir. No one sees Mr. Denham. No one at all. Ever.
If you were to mention my name, I'm sure he'd see me. Van Helsing.
Waste of time, sir. I assure you. Excuse me. Security reception? Yes, sir. Got my standing instructions. Yes, sir. You ought to go up to Mr. Denham's private apartment, sir.
Thank you.
Van Helsing notes the security camera.
Doesn't that thing make you feel self-conscious?
All part of the job. Take the lift and press the red button. It'll stop right outside his suite. And, sir, you're not carrying a camera, are you? My instructions.
No camera.
Van Helsing walks over to the bank of elevators. At Pelham House, Murray lies on his back on the stone floor of a darkened chamber. He stirs, then slips back into unconsciousness as Qin Yang looks on. Back at the D.D. Denham building, Van Helsing rides the elevator. The doors slide open to reveal Denham silhouetted behind his desk. The light from his desk lamp is directed at his visitor.
Professor Van Helsing.
Mr. Denham.
I have been expecting you.
I rather thought you might.
Please sit down.
Van Helsing sits down across the desk from the distinguished executive.
I have been expecting you ever since Julian Keeley took his own life.
Or was he murdered?
He was the servant of this foundation. I am the master. His nerves failed him.
The project he was working on was enough to shatter anyone's nerve.
It is merely a deterrent, nothing more. There is a group of us who are determined that the decadence of the present day can and will be halted. A new political regime is planned to lend weight to one's arguments. Amid the rush and whirl of humanity, it is sometimes necessary to be persuasive.
Persuasive?
There are a few vague rituals, it is true. little occultism, a touch of mysticism at Pelham House, nothing more.
Evil begets evil. There is an unholy aura in this place. And it is not a question of a little occultism or a touch of mysticism, Mr. Denham. It is vampirism, and there's a host of damned souls at Pelham House. What are you going to do with me? You can't let me go, can you? I know too much. Do you mind if I smoke? It's a bad habit, I know, but it helps me to concentrate.
Van Helsing lights his cigarette with Denham's desk lighter. As he returns the lighter, he knocks books and files from the desk.
I'm sorry.
Kneeling to retrieve the objects, he pulls his small Bible pocket. Slipping the Bible under the files, he returns them and the books to the desktop.
Am I to suffer the same fate as Professor Keeley?
Denham points a finger at him.
You are an interfering man, Professor. Do not meddle, or you will have to deal with me.
Denham's hand touches the Bible, sending up a plume of smoke.
You are Count Dracula.
He reaches for his crucifix.
Of course. Mr. Denham, the powerful recluse. Here you are safe. No one expects to see him. Not in the daytime.
Van Helsing turns the light on Dracula, who backs away from the crucifix.
Soli Deo Gloria. Nisi Dominus. Frustra.
Van Helsing pulls his pistol from his coat.
Foolish man. A bullet cannot harm me.
A silver bullet, Dracula.
Dracula's smile fades as Van Helsing takes aim. Someone shoves Van Helsing, knocking the gun and crucifix from his hand. Recognizing John Porter, Van Helsing tries to escape, but Lord Carradine seizes him.
Kill him!
He threatened you!
Dracula raises a hand to quiet them.
It cannot be made so simple for him. Not for Van Helsing. For his granddaughter.
Van Helsing rushes Dracula, but the two cabinet ministers restrain him. Dracula grins triumphantly. At Pelham House, Murray stirs. A light bulb suspended from the cellar ceiling is switched on. Still dazed, Murray tries to sit up. His eyes gradually focus on a pile of gardening equipment stacked on the floor nearby. Qin Yang enters the cellar, smiling. Murray struggles groggily to his feet.
Where's Jessica?
I have her hidden away.
Well, I suggest you go and find her.
I would, I promise you. But first you must help me.
Help you?
I too want to get away from this place. I'm as much a prisoner as you are.
But you live here.
Not by choice. Leila.
Smiling and gazing up into Murray's eyes, Qin Yang draws near to him. Murray backs away, but she reaches out to him.
Leila.
She stares into Murray's eyes, hypnotizing him. Murray's eyelids droop closed. He opens them to gaze into Qin Yang's eyes. Then he bends and kisses her, and she returns his kiss passionately. As Qin Yang nuzzles Murray's neck, he pulls back. Qin Yang bares her fangs. Murray pushes her away.
In God's name!
Qin Yang renews her attack, but Murray throws a length of garden netting over her. As she struggles with the net, he tackles her, and they wrestle on the floor. Murray knocks over the pile of garden equipment. Seizing a wooden stake, he presses it to Qin Yang's chest, then he grabs a mallet and pounds the stake into her heart. Yang dies, and Murray scrambles off her. He slumps in a corner, catching his breath. A second vampire springs on him, struggling to sink her teeth into his neck. Murray shoves her back against a crate, reaches for the gardening equipment, and holds up two sticks in the form of a cross. The vampire shrinks from it. As Murray backs away, a third vampire approaches him, but he wards her off with the cross. The second vampire averts her eyes from the cross as Murray backs toward the cellar stairs. Murray stops with his back against the door, and the vampires creep forward, menacing him. Glimpsing the overhead sprinkler system, Murray notices the valve on the cellar wall. He opens the valve, turning on the sprinklers. Water inundates the vampires. They crumple to the floor, writhing in agony under the lethal effect of pure, clean water. On the main floor, Murray stops to catch his breath, then leaves his makeshift cross on a hall table. Crossing the foyer, he pauses as he notices an open door. In the red chamber, he finds a woman lying on the altar.
Jessica.
Draped in a white gown, Jessica lies perfectly still. Murray checks her pulse.
Please, God.
Leaving Jessica on the altar, he starts back across the room. Then he notices a surveillance camera mounted high on one wall. With a last look back at Jessica, then at the camera, he crosses the foyer toward the stairs. As Murray dashes up the stairs, the front door opens. Murray ducks into the hallway upstairs. Downstairs, the three cabinet ministers escort Van Helsing into the Red Chamber. Seeing his granddaughter, Van Helsing rushes forward, but Porter and Lord Carradine grab him and push him into a chair. From the doorway, Dracula surveys the chamber. His eyes fix on Jessica, and he walks across the chamber to the altar. As the Count steps behind the altar, hands restrain the professor. His hands palm down, Dracula traces Jessica's body in the air over the altar. With a flick of his wrists, he ignites the four black candles at the corners of the altar. General Freeborn closes the doors to the chamber. Upstairs, Murray creeps into a bedroom. Noticing the security monitoring equipment laid out on the tables, he switches on the light. Murray examines the equipment. Then he flicks a switch on a console, and the Red Chamber comes up on one of the video monitors. Time is 5 minutes to midnight.
On this, the eve of the Sabbat of the Undead, I call upon you to witness my supreme triumph. Van Helsing, I choose the spawn of your blood to be my consort.
Van Helsing stands. But under the force of Dracula's withering glare, He sinks reluctantly back into his seat. Upstairs, on the monitor, Murray watches Porter take a small box from a table beside the altar and open it, revealing a test tube.
The instrument of my final conquest.
Removing the test tube from the box, Porter holds it high before the altar. Murray leaves the room.
Swifter, more awesome than the Black Death. The plague.
Upstairs, Murray looks down from the landing to see a guard patrolling the foyer. He creeps back to the room.
In the first moments, every muscle, every fiber will be afire with torment and agony. In the days to come, you will pray for death. Release.
And so you destroy every living soul on this earth. You're left with an empty world to command. Is that what you want, Count Dracula? A last blaze of utter horror and violence? The ghastly annihilation of an entire planet? Is this your own death wish?
I have chosen four messengers of death. Four horsemen of my created apocalypse. Four carriers of the plague who will infect their miserable brethren. You, Van Helsing, are now one of the four. The body of your granddaughter will never be corrupted. It will be her joy to walk at my side.
Four carriers. Us? Do you mean us?
You said we would use the plague only as a deterrent.
To hold governments to ransom.
You promised us
we've
power.
We've served you faithfully.
Silence!
The girl that you love is mine already, and through her you will yet do my bidding.
Bending over Jessica, Dracula gazes on her face.
In your name, for you, everything we did exactly as we were commanded. In return, you promise.
Dracula peers intently at Porter. As the Count's eyes widen fiercely, Porter looks at the test tube in his hand. It's 1 minute to midnight. Dracula's hypnotic stare makes Porter's hand tremble as he tries to resist the Count's control. Dracula intensifies his mental projections. Against his will, Porter squeezes the tube till it shatters. Horrified, Porter turns to the Count, but Dracula just smirks triumphantly. As Porter sinks to his knees, General Freeborn backs away from him. Upstairs, the guard wields a length of metal pipe as he walks in on Murray.
Are you open to any deals?
The guard closes the door behind him. As the guard reaches for the telephone, Murray strikes. The guard swings the pipe, but Murray dodges it. Murray throws an elbow to the kidneys, but the guard kicks a chair at him and knocks him over. Downstairs, pustules have already broken out on Porter's chest. Upstairs, Murray heaves the telephone at the guard. He bolts for the door, but gets cut off. Grabbing the guard's wrist, he forces him across the room, wrestling for the pipe. The guard forces the pipe against Murray's throat, trying to choke him. Murray jams the heel of his hand under the guard's chin and forces him back. As they struggle, the guard kicks Murray in the crotch. Sinking to the floor in pain, he dodges a blow. The next blow catches him across the shoulders. Then he heaves the guard across the room, and the pipe connects with an electrical circuit. Hundreds of volts course through the guard's body as Murray makes his escape. In the Red Chamber, Porter writhes in agony as pustules break out across his body. He reaches for Lord Carradine, but Carradine backs away. The explosion upstairs knocks Murray to the floor, shatters the ceiling of the Red Chamber. Porter sinks to the floor as flames shoot up the walls. General Freeborn and Lord Carradine flee the room as Porter thrashes around in pain. Glancing over his shoulder to see the security station engulfed in flame, Murray struggles to his feet and stumbles down the stairs to the foyer. He finds Van Helsing staring through the flames at Dracula.
Hurry! Get Jessica away! Get her away, man! Hurry!
Murray dashes through the blaze and lifts Jessica from the altar. Dracula steps toward Van Helsing. The professor upends a table in his path, but the Count sends him and the table flying.
My revenge has spread over centuries and has just begun!
Outside, Murray carries Jessica across the grounds. Lurching across the room, Porter reaches out for Van Helsing's hand. Whoa! The professor dashes to the other side of the room. Outside, Murray lays Jessica down on the ground. Inside, Van Helsing raises a chair over his head and tosses it through a window. Then he clambers over the windowsill and out of the fiery Red Chamber. Dracula pursues the professor, leading the agonized Porter to the flames. Out on the grounds, Dracula hurries after Van Helsing. Meanwhile, Murray covers Jessica with his jacket and sets off across the grounds. Van Helsing makes his way through the gloomy woods. Dracula trails him through the trees. Back at the house, Murray plunges into the inferno. Through the doorway of the Red Chamber, he sees Porter, aflame and tumbling to the floor. Murray rushes off. Out in the woods, Van Helsing presses on. Count Dracula follows him through the night. Murray returns to Jessica and leans over her.
Jessica! Jessica!
In the woods, Van Helsing's coat catches on a branch. He pulls a thorn from the material.
How the hell do you fight a vampire?
There are many ways. The symbols of good are used to combat the forces of evil. The hawthorn tree, which provided Christ with his crown of thorns.
Van Helsing pushes past the hawthorn. Peering into the night, Dracula resumes the chase. Van Helsing stops behind the thick branches of the hawthorn.
Help, Dracula!
Dracula stops, trying to pinpoint the sound of Van Helsing's voice. Then he creeps on. Spots Van Helsing behind the hawthorn. He advances on the professor, but Van Helsing holds his ground. Dracula tries to push through the branches. A thorn pierces Dracula's hand. Plunges on, reaching for Van Helsing. Van Helsing stares fearlessly at the maddened vampire. Caught on the thorns, the Count tries to break free. Spotting a picket fence nearby, Van Helsing moves toward it. A bloodied Dracula thrashes about in the grip of the hawthorn. Breaking free, he topples to the ground, one ankle caught fast by a thorny branch. Kicks at the thorns in vain, his strength ebbing fast. Van Helsing attacks the fence. He succeeds in pulling a picket free. Standing over the Count, he plunges the picket into his chest. Oh! thrust pins the vampire to the ground. Racked by spasms, the Count falls back and breathes his last. Exhausted, Van Helsing crouches near the vampire. Smoke rises from the Count's remains. Dracula's corpse molders before Van Helsing's eyes. The flesh melts from the bones with supernatural speed, leaving only a skeleton pinned to the ground by the stake through its chest cavity. Van Helsing gazes at the smoke rising wraith-like from the ground beneath the vampire's bones. The rotted flesh on Dracula's skull turns to dust and slips from the bone. Dracula's fangs protrude from the gaping maw in the vampire's smoking skull. The dust that was flesh falls from the fingers of the skeleton's hand. The skeleton's backbone collapses. Head bowed, Van Helsing peers at the remains of the Lord of the Undead as they turn to dust. Van Helsing starts to walk away, then turns back. Stooping, he plucks a metallic object from the smoldering dust. Blowing it clean of ash, he gazes solemnly at Count Dracula's ring. This described version of The Satanic Rites of Dracula was created by Audiovision Canada. The narrative description was written by Bill Williams, narrated by Steve Coombs, and produced by Valerie Hunter and Marco Soria. For information on other described movies and audio cinema presentations available from Audiovision Canada, call toll-free 1-800-567-6755. Cast: Christopher Lee, Count Dracula; Peter Cushing, Van Helsing; Michael Coles, Murray; William Franklin, Torrance; Freddie Jones, Professor Keeley; Joanna Lumley, Jessica; Richard Vernon, Matthews; Barbara Yu Ling, Chin Yang. A Hammer production, made at EMI MGM Elstree Studios, Boreham Wood, Hertfordshire, England.